From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Election season never really ends.
Stop running a campaign.
What?
Just quit. It would be so cool of you if you just quit. Then I can win the election, and I'll have a big party, and I'll put you both on the guest list.
A special election is coming up in a week, and so we'll talk about our democracy and how healthy it is. Also, we'll hear from Ambassador Andrew Young. He's speaking at the HOPE Global Forum today. That's all coming up. But first, tell us how often you vote. Just presidential elections every 4 years, or do you turn out for the special elections and the midterms and the school board elections? How important are the smaller votes? Call us at 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk, and we might feature your comments on the show. Tom Price has taken a job in the Trump administration, and that means his congressional seat is empty. And the race to fill it is contentious and expensive. But that's the democratic process. That's how it works. Centuries ago, though, Plato predicted democracy is always doomed to fail and eventually die. He said a tyrant will always rise in democracies and end the free system. Was he right? Conservative commentator Andrew Sullivan thinks he might be. He said this to Slate magazine.
The idea of sharing power or being checked by other branches of government, or even checked by the press, seems anathema to him. And I think when you have someone with that kind of temperament walking into our constitutional system, you are kind of setting yourself up for a constitutional crisis.
So last year, before the election, we spoke with two experts about this, Robert Perro of Georgia Southern University and Michael Evans of Georgia State University. I started off by asking Michael if Andrew Sullivan's comments about a constitutional crisis are accurate.
For the question of whether our democracy is about to die and whether whether Trump presents a real threat of a tyrant like Plato had in mind, I think is very far-fetched. I think that you have to think through what would it take. What would it take for any candidate, for any president, to present a true threat of an authoritarian takeover of our government? And here you have to look at the institutional framework, the fact that we have the separation of powers, the fact that we have civilian control of the military and a military that is indoctrinated into a strong respect for the rule of law and democracy and for the Constitution. I think that someone who has authoritarian tendencies and who embraces political violence the way that Donald Trump does, I think that they can be very damaging. I think that they are antithetical to a lot of our highest democratic ideals, but I don't think that they present a threat to the continuance of our democracy.
Yeah, that's a little different than a constitutional crisis. Robert, let me play you this comment from Fox News host Bill O'Reilly. He was speaking on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, and he's talking about both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders here.
Trump and Sanders are the same guy because they're both tapping into anger, the anger of the voter who feels they're getting hosed. The good part about it is it gets people engaged in a political process. Uh-huh. So that's good. What's bad is both Trump and Sanders say stuff that's impossible. That could never happen. And their followers, I guess, don't really care.
When was the last time the world saw a democracy usurped by tyranny, Robert? Was it Germany? When was it?
Well, Germany is probably the most prominent example that one can think of in the recent past. But I'd like to go back to that comment by O'Reilly. And I think it's important to make a distinction between Trump and Sanders. I mean, when you think about the threats to democracy, there are at least two that come to mind immediately, and that's factionalism. And what I mean by that is that when groups in society are unwilling to tolerate sharing power with others. And I think that Trump really is a kind of standard bearer for that threat, that he and I think some of his followers anyway are intolerant of sort of limits. And so that's the threat he poses. Now, with Sanders, I think he's actually putting his finger on the other red flag, I think, the other threat to democracy, which is corruption, which is public officials using their power for private gain. And I think that Sanders is not—he's not a corrupt person, but he's putting his—he's sort of putting his finger on that threat to democracy. So I see it. I would say that in this election cycle, we see two red flags out there for the threats to democracy. One is factionalism, which Trump, I think, he exemplifies, and the other one is corruption, which Bernie Sanders is doing his best to sort of put a spotlight on.
Mike, those are factionalism and corruption, especially when it's tied to money, are two things that Plato pointed out as red flags to the death of democracy. But do you still accept those kind of things as red flags, even in our modern American democracy?
Yeah, for having a healthy democracy that you know that's functional and lives up to for us to live up to our full potential as a constitutional democracy that respects human rights and the rule of law. Absolutely, corruption and factionalism are a problem. I think you know I would say that our partisan polarization that we have today is an example of the problem of factionalism as well as.
Yeah. It's funny you say that because let me play this comment from Paul Ryan. He's a Republican Speaker of the House, and he says he doesn't think democracy works with a two-party system in the executive and legislative branch. Here he is speaking with Fox News host Megyn Kelly.
We're going to offer specific plans. We're going to say, here is what we could do with a Republican president in 2017.
To try to get the
if
voters
you elect
motivated.
Us, this is what we'll do. Because the key is we have to have the people break this tie. We have this divided government, liberal president, conservative Congress. It's not working.
So you don't think anything could get done unless it's one-party rule?
Look at the path we are on.
So how do you put that into context, Robert?
Well, I think I would go back to the comment that Dr. Evans just made, and that is this partisan sort of polarization. But I think really historically, if you look at it, what's happened is that and I think that there's plenty of evidence of this, that the Republican Party's moved more to the right and the Democrats have moved more to the center as they've been pulled in that direction. And once again, I think that and the idea that the only way we can get things done is by having unitary party rule. I mean, that makes me a little uncomfortable. I think that you know, in the past, we've had presidents from one party and Congresses controlled by the other, and there's been cooperation. And what's happened today is that. You know, for many people, that's no longer a possibility. And that's definitely worrisome for people who believe in democracy.
Now, Mike, is it possible that if our democracy is weak or threatened at this point, is it possible that's because of apathy? I mean, among the developed nation, I think we have almost the lowest amount of voter participation of any developed world. Is it because people simply aren't participating?
Lack of participation. It's not all due to apathy. A lot of it has to do with our registration laws and the rules governing the game that make it harder to vote in this country than in other countries. So I don't equate low turnout with apathy necessarily, although there is a lot of that. There's also widespread ignorance by citizens, and we don't want to say that, but it's true. The opinion polls, 50 years of political science research have borne it out. There is a disturbingly high level of ignorance and disengagement. So I think, you know, we definitely, anytime you're talking about the prospects for democracy, you must look at civic education. And it's probably our...
Most schools don't have civics anymore.
One of the most worrisome developments. I think that we need to reinvigorate our civic education in this country. Absolutely.
All right. Let me play you another clip. And again, we're talking about whether or not democracy is doomed from the start to fail, as Plato suggested. And we're talking about political divisiveness, so that makes this next bit of tape kind of relevant. There was an amendment that would have given protection for members of the LGBT community. That amendment failed. The Hill newspaper said that it was supposed to pass. They thought it would pass. But Republican leaders urged their members to change their votes. And if you'll hear here, the lawmakers begin chanting, shame. So, Michael, is this kind of divisiveness in Congress a good sign? I mean, maybe this shows that people are passionate, or is this one of the red flags that Plato told us to watch for?
I think sometimes we need to distinguish between our crisis of governance and the crisis of our democracy. You know, in some ways, democracy is about passion and about standing up for beliefs and standing. Up for our ideological commitments. And so in some ways, as Andrew Sullivan says, this is a sign of a lot of democracy in our system. But that doesn't necessarily make for workable government, particularly with our institutions. Our institutions we have the separation of powers. We have a bicameral legislature. We have a system of fragmented institutions that were designed to force deliberation and compromise and bargaining in order to enact laws. And when you have polarized political parties with very homogeneous ideological commitments, it makes it very difficult for us to govern. And this does also, I think, creates a creates conditions when people, I think, we see disaffection with our system of government, particularly by the by young Americans at a higher level than older Americans. And I think, you know, they've grown up during this economic crisis and they've seen a government that's unable, incapable of taking action. And that's a disturbing sign that they will believe that this kind of inability for our parties to come together and compromise in the way that we need them to is a sign with a problem with democracy, and that would make me worry.
Okay, so then Robert, look, I know that people often immediately jump to the Hitler comparisons, and to a certain extent, I feel like that's understandable, because obviously people would be afraid of that. The world watched a democracy fall into fascism, and it's in some way healthy that to be afraid of that and want that not to happen again. But what do you make of Andrew Sullivan's core theory that at this point there are so many cracks in the wall that we could be in danger of the rise of a tyrant?
Well, I have a close friend who's a retired lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, and he's been very concerned by the fact that at one of the debates Trump said that were he commander in chief and he were to order the military to do something that was unconstitutional, he would expect them to follow his order. I think he later walked that back, but I can understand why Trump, for many people, is a frightening Trump presidency is a frightening prospect. But I have a little more. Maybe I'm a little more optimistic. I mean, Dr. Evans was talking about the possibility that young people might be turned off to politics, might see all this anger as a problem with democracy rather than governance. But once again, if you look at this last campaign and you look at the and once again the Bernie Sanders campaign and the young people that he's brought out. People who want to be engaged, who have a positive agenda. I think that there are signs of renewal possibly there as well.
And yet, speaking on the Democrat side, Michael, there many young people are disenchanted by the democratic process. So is there another bit of a yellow warning sign there?
I suspect they're going to come around. I think they feel like the Democratic Party's nomination process, they feel,
is
unfair.
Okay, so in the 30 seconds that we have left, Michael Evans of Georgia State University, the state of our democracy is?
Sick, but not on its deathbed.
Robert Pirro of Georgia Southern, the state of our democracy is?
It's under pressure, as democracies are timed again, but I think it has the resources to overcome this.
Okay. I guess that's a little bit of cautious optimism from our two political scientists. Michael Evans teaches at Georgia State University. Robert Pirro teaches at Georgia Southern. They both teach political science. Michael and Robert, thank you both so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be on.
Coming up, there is a difference between Hispanic and Latino. We'll explain why they're not interchangeable. First, though, Ambassador Andrew Young talks about the power of the vote. This is On Second Thought.
Immigration, socialism, capitalism, racism, healthcare, welfare, seems like nobody cares. Big business corporations, small business taxation, unemployment, education, my generation. Build a space station, so when you do a Earth, you can see all the Haitians as they rebuild their nation. With fair trade, everybody trade, you trade, I trade, and everybody get paid. Election time around the corner, who you gonna vote?
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The Voting Rights Act has been law for half a century. Here's President Lyndon B. Johnson in 1965.
Today is a triumph for freedom, as huge as any victory that's ever been won on any battlefield.
Johnson was probably right to compare the situation to war. There were battles. There were casualties. It was a hard-won victory.
Millions of Americans are denied the right to vote because of their color. This law will ensure them the right to vote.
And Andrew Young was there from the beginning. He helped Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. draft that bill. Young went on to become a congressman, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, and of course, the mayor of Atlanta. He'll speak tonight at the Hope Global Forum in downtown Atlanta, and I spoke with him a couple years ago. I started off by asking him to explain the challenges minorities faced at the polls before the passage of the Voting Rights Act.
Before the Voting Rights Act, here's a good illustration. My younger brother was a lieutenant in the Navy, a Navy dentist. He went back to Louisiana and he took the state boards in dentistry, and it's a 5-day exam. He finished it in 3 days and passed and was certified as a dentist in the state of Louisiana. And while he was waiting for everybody else to finish, he went over to try to register to vote. And they told him he flunked the literacy test. Now, that's about as ridiculous as it can get. But that was in my own family. When one of the farmers took a group to register to vote that he had been working with and trained in Emmett County, Mississippi, the sheriff met him on the steps and drew a gun and said, "What do you want, boy?" He's about 58 years old. And he said, "I'm here to register to vote." Sheriff pulled his gun and put it directly in his forehead and cocked it and said, "What did you say, boy?" And fortunately, Mr. Steptoe is his name. And he said, "Brother Steptoe said, if I live, I am going to be a registered voter."
Did he get to register?
He did get to register, but not until 3 civil rights workers were killed. It was really a terrible and evil time in many ways. We were simply asking for the right to vote, which is a basic human right that people had fought 2 wars for and were coming back from Vietnam having fought another one. And they couldn't be registered voters.
Let's take a listen here to the same kind of passion that you're exhibiting. It obviously came from Martin Luther King Jr. himself. Here he is speaking in Selma at a march where you were present. This is before the Voting Rights Act was passed.
"We've lived with slavery and segregation. 345 years we waited a long time for freedom. We are trying to remind the nation of the urgency of the moment. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time."
Did the Voting Rights Act solve this, what he was talking about?
The Voting Rights Act went a long way toward solving it because it made it possible. We went from almost no black elected officials to over 600 southwide in a matter of the first 2 or 3 years. And there has been an increase of political participation across the nation because of the Voting Rights Act. But we needed the presence of federal enforcement. We needed—
You're talking about that very enforcement piece that was struck down.
That was struck down by the Supreme Court. Now, I don't want to argue with the Supreme Court, because what they said might be true. We are doing better in the South than we were 50 years ago. But the voter suppression now is both North and South. The Supreme Court said you can't single out the South anymore because the South is doing better. And it sent it back to Congress. Well, really, Congress would have to extend the Voting Rights Act to cover Ohio, Florida, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, all places where we are seeing the kind of voter suppression that we used to see down south. It's a lot more sophisticated, but it's just about as difficult to deal with.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Ambassador Andrew Young about the Voting Rights Act. You wrote an op-ed in which you said you thought now was the time to compromise and to go back and reform the Voting Rights Act, create the Voting Rights Act 2.0. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I was talking about that because what happened to us? For instance, we can pretty much protect ourselves in Fulton County in Georgia. We have enough registered voters. We are well enough represented in this.
When you say state, you mean African Americans.
African Americans. But minorities in Ohio had to go through some of the same things to try to keep their voting rights from being suppressed. Republican-controlled legislators have gerrymandered districts to the point where a true non-racial democracy is very, very difficult to implement.
I want to play for you another clip. This is, again, from President Johnson around the time that the Voting Rights Act was signed. This is him actually making the argument to Congress about why they needed this.
Their cause must be our cause, too. Because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
I wonder at this point, besides African Americans, who do you think are the people most affected by the loss of the enforcement portion of the Voting Rights Act?
I think the senior citizens are, of all colors. The combination of things gives one small group an unfair advantage, and it cripples democracy. I want democracy and free enterprise to work for everybody.
Sounds to me like you're saying the Voting Rights Act is important because the more people that vote, the more likely they are to throw the bums out. I mean, that's almost right. I mean, the more people that participate, the better representation we get in Washington.
Well, yes, the better representation we get in Washington is absolutely right.
But the turnout is terrible. I mean, the last best turnout we had in the past 100 years or so was maybe 1960, Kennedy v. Nixon. We got like 63%.
In Israel, they vote over the weekend, and it's compulsory, and they're 90% turnout. In Sweden, if you don't vote, you're penalized on your taxes. Most democracies believe in the judgment of the people. We make it more and more difficult for people to register and for people to vote. And you get discouraged and humiliated.
I wonder, though, if the tenets of the Voting Rights Act are outdated at this point. And the reason I say that is because the vast majority, over 70% of Americans, think American elections are rigged. They think there's so much money in the game at this point that their vote means nothing.
I hate to get cynical. And the amazing thing about black men and women from slavery through segregation, we never gave up on America. And we always believed that we could make America become what the founding fathers intended, liberty and justice for all. And if you lose faith in that, what is there to live for? We've got enough intolerance and hatred in the world to cope with. We don't need it in our politics. And the Voting Rights Act helped us to rise up a little higher. And Lyndon Johnson, as a Southerner, who had seen, as he said, he had been in the classroom and he had seen young Latino children coming to school unable to stay awake because they hadn't had anything to eat. And he vowed as a teacher that if he ever got a chance to do something about that, he would. And he reminded the Congress of that when he signed the Voting Rights Act, that it was because he saw the harm that was done by a democracy that didn't help the poor, that he wanted to make America the great society.
Ambassador Andrew Young, former Congressman, Mayor of Atlanta, Ambassador to the United Nations, thank you so much.
Well, it's my pleasure.
That's former UN Ambassador Andrew Young. He'll speak tonight at the Hope Global Forum in Atlanta. Let's take a moment now to remember another important figure in the struggle for civil rights, Alice Dunnigan. When Dunnigan started work as a journalist, the White House Press Corps was an exclusive club of all-male, mostly white reporters. Dunnigan was not only an African-American woman, but also determined to make politicians go on the record about civil rights. Here she is posing a question about tenant farmers to John F. Kennedy at his first news conference as president in 1961.
Yes, ma'am.
Does your administration plan to take any steps to solve the problem at Fayette County, Tennessee, where tenant farmers have been evicted from their homes because they voted last November and must now live in tents?
We are, the Congress, of course, enacted legislation which placed very clear responsibility on the executive branch to protect the right of voting. I am extreme. I supported that legislation. I am extreme.
It's hard to hear her there because she's not mic'd, but she's asking the president a pretty tough question about farmers who were evacuated from their land. Alice Dunnigan's career as a White House reporter spanned several administrations. In 1974, Dunnigan wrote a memoir about her time in Washington called Alone Atop the Hill. I spoke with Carol Booker in 2015. She edited a reissue of the autobiography for the University of Georgia Press. And I began the conversation by asking her why they decided to change the title of the book when it was reissued. It was originally called A Black Woman's Experience from Schoolhouse to the White House.
Well, there were two reasons. The primary one was it didn't reflect the depths, really, from which she rose. And Alice asks us at the beginning of her autobiography to judge her not by the heights that she reached, but by the depths from which she rose. And that was as a daughter of a sharecropper and a laundress. She struggled hand over fist to become a rural school teacher. And so the original title, saying From Schoolhouse to the White House, left out the struggle of her early life to do that. Another reason was, some detractors, and she had many, particularly among men. She says in the book she suffered more sex discrimination than race discrimination, and some of her male competitors, detractors, substituted outhouse for schoolhouse.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, I wanted to go back briefly before we talk about her incredibly storied career in D.C. and talk about her childhood a little bit. Could you tell us how much of a struggle it was for her to complete her education and actually have any kind of certification to become a teacher?
Oh, it was extremely difficult. First of all, she lived 2 miles outside of Russellville, Georgia, a town of, I think it was about 5,000 then. She lived on a hill, no other kids around, and she wanted desperately to go to school. She just wanted, probably partially out of loneliness, and to be with other children. And so she walked by herself the 2 miles to school and the 2 miles home in all kinds of weather. And her father even taunted her, saying it was foolish to go out when it was raining or in the snow. And her mother had second thoughts, but she bundled her up nevertheless. Alice finished the only school available for blacks in that area. It was called the Knob City High School, but it was 8 elementary school grades and 2 years of high school. And then when she finished, her parents so disappointed her by telling her they didn't have the money to send her on for further education.
Yeah. But she was saved by actually a local dentist.
Yes. She was the Sunday school secretary. And after a terribly miserable summer, knowing that her school friends were going off to college, many of them who were worse off than she was, some of them had widowed parents and less money. But still, her parents still, they felt they didn't have the money for this, and her father felt no one in his family had ever been a teacher, so why should she? But to Alice, the choices were quite stark. It was either become a teacher or become a domestic servant in the home of a white family, and she didn't want that. She really wanted dignity and respect and the opportunity to use her intellect.
Let's speed forward a little bit. We had that clip of tape of her asking a question to John F. Kennedy. And one of the things that comes to light in the memoir is the different way she was treated by different presidential administrations. How did that actually, I mean, obviously JFK, you point out, was a very different president in terms of how he treated her than Eisenhower, for example.
Oh, this was a major turning point in that news conference that you just played. Alice had asked the same kinds of questions, always civil rights questions, for the 8 years that Eisenhower was in office, and she attended just about every one of his almost weekly news conferences. But Eisenhower got very irritated at her for asking civil rights questions. He didn't want to talk about civil rights. He didn't know the answer sometimes, and he didn't want any questions that he couldn't answer. So he would chastise her and say, "Why are you asking me that? Have you asked the Bureau of Engraving, or have you asked the Department of Agriculture?" As if the heads of these federal agencies and departments did not have accountability to the President of the United States on a constitutional
right, level. And then he began ignoring her entirely.
Oh, for years. 2 years, and then he'd ask her a question, answer a question. And then from 1958 until he left office in January 61, he didn't call on her at all.
I spoke with Carol Booker in 2015. She edited a reissue of the autobiography for the University of Georgia Press. Coming up, mixing up Hispanic and Latino is mostly an American problem. We'll break it down for you. This is On Second Thought. Las estrellas y la luna ya me dicen dónde voy. Ay, 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 ay. Ay, ay, mi amor. Ay, mi morena de mi corazón. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The University of Georgia suspended one of its fraternities because of misconduct during a hazing ceremony. The city commission has also temporarily banned the construction of new bars downtown. So our question is this: does Athens have a partying problem? We'll talk about that tomorrow, but we'd love to get your opinion. Call us at 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk, and then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. Here's a scenario for you. Imagine a priest from South America becomes the Pope. Because that's what did happen, and it appeared in headlines around the world. First Hispanic Pope, some read. Others said Pope Francis becomes the first Latino Pope. And one even said first Spanish Pope. Then an online magazine enters the discussion with this headline: Pope Francis is not Latino and barely Latin American. What? Latino and Hispanic are often used interchangeably, but actually they're not the same thing. So who is Latino and who's Hispanic? Let's break it down. Break it down, baby, because I want y'all all to know. Let me break it down for you again. Break it down now. Break it down. According to the U.S. Census, Hispanics are the largest minority group in the country, and their numbers are growing. Nearly one out of five people in America has Hispanic roots. Or is it Latino roots? And what about Cuba? The discussion over what to call people with roots in Spain, Central America, South America, or the Caribbean is ongoing, and it's not always civil. A few years back, CNN aired this report.
CNN's Thelma Gutierrez shows us you can't define race by just checking a little box.
What are Latinos? What do they look like? You may be surprised.
We go from black to white, so we have mestizo, we have indigenous, we have Arab.
And some of us are Asian. I'm Chinese and Mexican. But contrary to what most people think, Latino is not a race, and it's not a particular ethnic group.
The discussion in the comments for that video was entertaining.
Hispanic is an ethnicity, not a race.
No, Hispanic has nothing to do with ethnicity. Oh my God, it has to do with language. Please go back to school.
Latino or Hispanic is not a race. Latinos are those who speak languages derived from Latin language.
Spaniards are Hispanic. South Americans like Brazilians, Argentinians, and Portuguese are Latinos. However, people use both since it means the same thing.
You know Portugal is not in South America, right?
I'm Portuguese, and Portuguese people are not Hispanic.
Wikipedia has an entire page dedicated to what it calls the Hispanic-Latino naming dispute, so let me try and clear this up as best I can. First of all, this confusion is a uniquely American problem. We are really the only nation that calls people either Latino or Hispanic. Outside the U.S., people are described as Cuban or Guatemalan or Mexican. But it was a Texas woman who recommended the U.S. government use the term Hispanic to describe this very large, diverse group of people, Grace Flores Hughes. She says the term's meant to include all people of Spanish descent. She doesn't like the word Latino because she thinks that includes everyone whose language is based on Latin, and that would include Italians and other Europeans.
Some people like to argue that you're not Latino because you don't speak Latin. But that's just silly because Asian people don't speak Asian. They speak Japanese or Korean or Chinese or Thai.
Let's settle the simplest one first, Spanish. Spanish is a Romance language spoken by about 400 million people around the world. Spanish is also a nationality, and it refers only to people who are from Spain. A Mexican is not Spanish, even though he or she might speak Spanish. Now let's move on to the more complicated terms, Latino and Hispanic. There are some who say the two terms are basically the same thing.
We use them interchangeably, but actually Hispanic is an English term and used to really refer to people from Spain, and then it kind of expanded to refer to people in Spanish colonies.
That's Soledad O'Brien, who's half Cuban and half Australian, but born in St. James, New York, so she's 100% American. But many people don't agree that Latino and Hispanic are interchangeable. So let me explain the distinction. Hispanic refers to someone whose ancestry traces back to Spain or another Spanish-speaking country. So Soledad O'Brien would be Hispanic because Cubans speak Spanish. And Cuba was claimed for Spain by good old Christopher Columbus back in 1492.
Christopher Columbus, at your service. I'm told you're an Italian.
Oh, indeed I am, sir. From Genoa.
Latino, for most people, doesn't refer to the language Latin at all. Instead, it means you trace your ancestry to Latin America. Okay, quick geography lesson. Latin America starts at the southern border of the U.S., goes south all the way to the bottom of Chile, and stretches east to include the Caribbean. Cuba is part of the Caribbean, which means it's part of Latin America, which means Soledad O'Brien is both Hispanic and Latino and Caribbean American and Cuban and just plain American. Got it? Stay with me here. Let's do a quick quiz. If someone is from Brazil, what do we call them? Latino, because she's from Latin America, but speaks Portuguese, not Spanish, so she's not Hispanic. How about a guy from the Dominican Republic? That guy is both Hispanic and Latino, because the Dominican Republic is a former Spanish colony where people speak Spanish in Latin America.
We got another notice from the fire department saying that we have to clear out the bush. You said you were going to get Jose to do it.
He's your garden, and why you don't tell him?
Lucy, you know I don't speak Mexican.
I'm not a Mexican.
Great, what was that all about?
Lucy's from El Salvador.
So?
It's an entirely different country.
Hispanic refers to a history with Spain or the Spanish language. Latino refers to a specific place on the map. I know a lot of this can be confusing, so take a tip from me. Unless you're the U.S. Census and you have to separate people into groups, don't worry about the labels at all. Just call the person Soledad or Celeste or
Angela, Pamela, Sandra, and Rita,
or whatever their actual name is. That's a quick lesson in the difference between Hispanic and Latino, but I am neither. So let's bring in an expert to make sure we got it all right. You've heard Hector Fernandez before on this show if you're a frequent listener. He joins our break room team often, and he's also a professor in the Department of World Languages and Cultures at Georgia State University. We asked Hector to help us better understand this issue.
Latin American comes from the French in the 19th century. Then the U.S. government, I mean, and so I'm speaking about the people who live over here, not people elsewhere. The Pope, for that matter, is Latin American. From the Nixon administration, the term Hispanic came from the Nixon administration. And close to 30 years later, within the context of the Clinton administration, the term Latino emerged officially. That does not mean that the terms were not used before. They were used before. But those are the points of official embracement or inception. The different originally was somewhere along the lines of originally. Hispanic was favored by people on the East Coast, and Latino was favored by people from the West Coast originally. Now it's all mixed, so it doesn't really matter. But on a general basis, it has to do with this. Hispanic means, whether you like it or not, you're prioritizing, you're giving more importance to your European descent. Hispanic, whether people realize it or not, in terms of the word itself, comes from Hispania. And Hispania was a Roman colony. And sadly, for the Brazilians and the Portuguese, that Roman colony included Portugal. The part of Portugal was called Lusitania, Hispania, Lusitania, but it was part of Hispania, if you want to be really strict about it, which I don't endorse. But originally, that's the way it works. Latino, on the other hand, is not about European descent. People who identify with Latino is because they want to prioritize coming from Latin America, having a Latin American context, being proud of sometimes mestizo roots or mulatto roots or something else that doesn't have to be with all Europe. So generally speaking, those are two big differences.
What do you make then of this argument that Latino means that your language derives from Latin?
See, that's I'll give you a great example. Antonio Banderas, right? He comes from southern Spain. He moved to the States. He married Melanie Griffith, you know, the works, whatever. He became a star over here.
The became culture, Zorro, yeah.
Yeah, the culture calls him Latino. And he is Latino. But he's from Spain. He doesn't have anything to do with Latin America. To that extent, you would have to justify then, just for him and for a few other Spaniards, you know, the reading that, sure, he comes from Spain. A context is basically emerging from, you know, Latin, the language. So the definition doesn't work equally for everybody.
Wait, we would call him Latino instead of Hispanic? Well, you'd call him both Latino and Hispanic,
yes.
Even though he's not, he's from Spain, he's not from Latin America.
Yeah, I wouldn't call him. The culture calls him Latino.
Oh, I see.
The culture alludes to him as Latino. He's Hispanic and Latino. Personally, I call him Spanish. He comes from Spain.
Yeah, he's Spanish.
He's Spanish. But the culture calls him Latino, and all the films he has made, you know, with for the kids and stuff, I mean, they market him as a Latino star.
So let me read you a couple of these tweets and get your response. We have one from at That Was Deep, who says, this mostly indexes generational / political outlook. Younger, more English-speaking are Latinos, older Hispanic. Hispanic, as functional term, took off through government, especially the census, based off language, ethnicity, and then identity model. What do you make of all that?
On a general basis, I wouldn't disagree. I would say one thing, though. Latino is basically embraced by people. There is a big distinction, which I wouldn't draw so much between Hispanic and Latino, but between Latin American and Latino. A lot of people migrate to the States, and they keep on calling themselves Latin American for years. And it's only when you identify yourself with the U.S. context and you say, I live over here, this is my home, this is my place, then you become Latino.
Interesting.
You have people who live, 40, 50 years in the States, they speak only Spanish. They never learn English. And you ask them, and either they have a nationality, some other nationality, or they'll say, I'm Latin American. So that's another distinction. On a general basis, what they wrote about Hispanic and Latino, sure. But I wouldn't give much importance to what the government said. You know,
yeah.
I mean, the government said something, and that was lost long time ago.
So why, I mean, we talked about this, and in almost no other countries do they split people this way. Is this argument over Hispanic versus Latino? And one of my friends was like, well, why can't I just be Guatemalan? And why do you think that is? Why has our country had these struggles over these labels?
Because first of all, we want to integrate people. We're talking about the nation. We're not talking about, you know, a conglomerate of nationalities. You're going to become American. If you're going to become American, sure, you can have a double nationality if you want to. But for practical purposes, you have to be something over here. And very few other nations in the world have the mixture of nationality we have. And the processes, the cultural processes by which we integrate people into our population are perhaps unique. I mean, the only country in the Americas that remotely resembles the cultural and racial diversity that we have is Brazil. and the mechanisms for integration in Brazil are sadly lacking in comparison to us.
So you are originally, your family's from Colombia, correct?
Yes, yes.
So you are Latino?
I'm Latino.
And also Hispanic?
Yes, I'm Hispanic, but I don't
You don't like to be called that?
I don't like to be called Hispanic.
Because you don't like to reflect back on European ancestry?
I have no problem with it. The language I speak is European descent, whether it's English or whether it's Spanish. But I'm not European. And that, to me, is very clear.
Do people offend all the time by using the wrong term? Do you get offended when people call you Hispanic?
No, I don't get offended. I don't think anybody has a chip on his shoulder to that extent. I mean, some people take it radically, but on a general basis, you know, there's such a confusion in the culture that I think hardly would take it, anybody would take it badly.
Okay, so can we go back to the Pope?
The Pope.
Okay, so the Pope is from Brazil.
The Pope is from Argentina.
Argentina, excuse me. The Pope is from Argentina. He speaks Spanish.
Yes.
He obviously, since he's the Pope and he's okay with the Vatican, it seems like he wouldn't have a trouble reflecting back on Europe, right? So we could call him Hispanic?
He's Hispanic, yes, absolutely.
And Latino, because he's from Latin America.
He's not Latino because he does not live in the United States of America. Latino is a label for people who live in the United States of America. He's Latin American.
Oh, this is an interesting wrinkle here. So the Pope is Latin American mm-hmm. and Hispanic,
yes,
but not Latino because he's clearly not American.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Okay. And Hispanic to the extent that he comes from Argentina, which is a country that has a strong history of immigration with, in some cases, well, with more European roots than the rest of Latin America. That's why label him Hispanic in some sense. But more than anything, I would say the Pope would define himself as Argentine and Latin American, and that's it. Hispanic or Latino are labels that we use for our population over here.
In America.
In the States.
That's an American problem.
It's not a problem. it's just an American practice, a cultural practice.
Okay. Let me put this out to the listeners. Do we need categories like this, Latino, Hispanic? Can we just say Colombian American or American? Do terms like this help us understand or categorize or hurt? You can tweet your thoughts to us at OST, OST Talk. Hector, do you have any last thoughts on that?
Some people don't like hyphenated identities. Personally, I don't mind them. I think they're practical. But a lot of people don't like them.
Okay. It's a sticky situation, it can be, especially if you're concerned about offending people, which I think most people are. My guest is Hector Fernandez. He's a professor of world languages and cultures at Georgia State University. As always, Hector, it's great to see you and have you on.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. But we want to hear from you. How often do you vote? Only every 4 years, or do you turn out for smaller elections like the special election coming up in the 6th district next week? Call us at 404-500-9457 or find us on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.